Game on 2FM.
Thanks to the superstar Jenny Green, it's Monday the 19th of April and this is Game On.
Coming up today, football's not coming home. Rob Harris and Stephen Kelly have the latest on the Super League and soccer's need for greed.
Seriously, in the midst of a pandemic, an economic crisis, football clubs at National League level going bust nearly, furloughing players, clubs on the edge in League 1 and 2, and these lot are having Zoom calls about breaking away and basically creating more greed.
And while the future of football is changing by the minute, at least we have the comfort of a hurling draw to dissect with Shane McGrath, who will be the surprise package out of Munster this year.
Now Stephen Bennett, they need a goal. Here is Stephen Bennett. Bennett's got it.
He's given the goal.
He was almost hooked in there. Stephen Bennett, that is just what they wanted.
All that plus the rest of today's sports news between now and Tara Stewart at 7 o'clock.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. So the biggest news in sport right now is a proposal to create a European Super League, which has generated fury in the football world. So far, 12 teams, including AC Milan, Arsenal, Atletico Madrid, Chelsea, Barcelona, Inter Milan, Juventus, Liverpool, Manchester City, Manchester United, Real Madrid and Tottenham Hotspur are confirmed to be part of this new league. Three additional clubs were expected to join before the first season, while another five were meant to qualify annually based on their performance during the previous season. But Marie, this story has been evolving all day. What's the latest?
We're starting to get a lot of reaction. UEFA boss Alexander Seferin called it disgraceful, self-serving proposal and that it is fuelled purely by greed. Let's hear from him.
I cannot stress more strongly at this moment, UEFA and the footballing world stand united against the disgraceful, self-serving proposal we have seen in the last 24 hours from a select few clubs in Europe that are fuelled purely by greed. Above all else, our game has become the greatest sport in the world based on open competition, integrity and sporting merit. And we cannot allow and we will not allow that to change. Never, ever. As previously announced by FIFA and the six confederations, the players who will play in the teams that might play in the closed league will be banned on playing the World Cup and Euro. So they will not be able to represent their national teams at any matches. So we urge everyone, from the millions of football lovers around the world, the world's media gathered in this call today, politicians and football's governing bodies, to stand tall with us as we do everything in our power to ensure this never ends up in fruition.
So that's UEFA boss Alexander Seferin there giving his views on this Super League. The English Football League has called it an attack on open and fair competition, and the Scottish Professional Football League described it as clear danger to the game. The Premier League has called a meeting for tomorrow morning for the 14 clubs not included in the European Super League discussions, and the so-called Big Six are not invited to attend this. And if that wasn't dramatic enough, earlier today Jose Mourinho was sacked as Tottenham Hotspur boss.
Just all in one day in the football world, isn't it, Marie? But anyway, look, to tell us more about this proposed league is Rob Harris from the Associated Press. Rob, I know you're a busy man. Thanks so many for taking our call. What is the reality of this Super League happening?
Great to join you. I mean, we've often heard about Super League threats over the years constantly coming up, but this seems to be the most realistic proposition of one happening to this day. The fact is, they have the website, they've got officials already in place in Spain, quite a few of them. They've got a structure built up. So it's a real sophisticated brinkmanship to try to force UEFA to get their vision if they're still trying to. I mean, and there's so much distrust now created. You just have to hear the words of Alexander Seferin, the UEFA president today, calling Andrea Agnelli a liar. Agnelli is the Juventus president, who up until yesterday was the chairman of the European Club Association, that up until Friday night was backing the new format for the Champions League from 2024. And yet, some of those people agree to that decision, actually, like Manchester United, like Juventus. like Real Madrid, actually, they're all plotting behind the scenes for this Super League, and it came to fruition over the weekend into an actual determination to bring it in as soon as they possibly can, in their view.
When is as soon as they possibly can? What's the likelihood? Are we talking 12 months, 24, 48?
Well, I mean, to me, if they are actually going ahead with it, it'd be really weird to start next season still within the Premier League. I mean, it just seems very hard to envisage it dragging on through next season when they've basically said, you know, when they've said they're launching a Super League and UEFA have already told them we're going to boot you out of all the other competitions if you do so, that they sort of stay in a transition period, as a phrase we've sort of become so used to in our countries in recent years. And, you know, they've got this threat about banning players from appearing at the Euros, even from teams that are part of the Super League. So a big decision for players, a big decision for clubs. What does someone like Jurgen Klopp say after Liverpool's game against Leeds tonight, when, you know, he's presented himself as very much a moral voice of football, and yet he knows his fans of the club are seemingly, based on the statements, against what the American ownership of the club has done.
So, Rob, we're hearing from fans and how disappointed they are. We're hearing the words greedy and money grabber has been thrown around as well. We will eventually, I'd say, hear from a few more managers with their views as well. But can these clubs justify what they're doing?
Well, I mean, in the sense of the way greed is put about, yes, that's exactly what it appears, because they could have signed up to the new Champions League deal as it was and got more games as they wanted with an expanded group stage. So they get 10 games rather than 6. And they were given some control of how the money is raised, the sale of TV rights, but they want even more control of it. But on the flip side, they will argue they generate the money. They've got the best players. They've got the most glamorous teams that are appealing to fans to watch on television. So why shouldn't they get a bigger slice of the cash? Why shouldn't they get to play each other more often? And that's where things stand in terms of this. And they also claim that they can raise more money to spread out to the non-Super League teams as well. Solidarity, as it is all called. UEFA currently gives around 150 million euros a year spread across to clubs who don't even make the Champions League or Super League, but they say they can get more. The question is, are these promises realistic? Can they generate the TV money that they're claiming to be able to generate in this uncertain market? Or, you know, do the financial promises not come to fruition as it stands now? They do have 4 million euros as a loan promised by JP Morgan Chase, the bank, to be able to get this thing off the ground, as they seem so determined to do.
Will 4 million get it off the ground? Would it not cost much more than that?
Well, it's things to underwrite it. They'd also hope to have the TV contracts in place and sign up to those. But, the question is, does a broadcaster risk signing up to them if they risk alienating themselves with existing rights holders? I think the key player to watch in all this is FIFA, because FIFA haven't very strongly condemned this. They put out a statement last night, but it was pretty weak. It was talking about being opposed to a closed breakaway league. And what the Super League clubs can say is it's not actually a closed league. It's a largely closed league, but they envisage 5 of the 20 spots being up for grabs still each year for teams to be able to still enter the competition. And the FIFA statement actually included some terminology about being favour effective redistribution of cash and solidarity payments, some of the very things that the Super League say they will deliver on. And that's, you know, it's one to watch, because the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, this year has been, and going back beyond this year, has been embroiled in talks with the Real Madrid president, Florentino Perez, about breakaway leagues. Perez is now the new chairman of this Super League while remaining at Real Madrid, and we've heard nothing from Infantino. We're due to tomorrow, because it's the big meeting of all UEFA nations, all 55 nations are meeting, some in person in Switzerland, some will be dialing in, and Infantino is due there. So it's a big moment to see how strongly he comes out in favour of the UEFA position, and whether or not he does assert and is a strident saying, as FIFA did earlier in the year, you're banned from the World Cup if you take part in a rebel league like this.
And what happens if he doesn't then, Rob? What happens if he doesn't take UEFA's stance, if he lends some support to this Super League?
That would be even more explosive for world football, because it could set FIFA up directly against UEFA, and effectively they claim themselves to be the global arbiters of football, and they're above everyone else, and they can help facilitate this competition. And then if the prospect of playing in the World Cup is still there, then that's alive. And who knows, they could just have the World Cup more often, for instance, something that FIFA have dangled as well, playing it every 2 years. So, you know, it's where the power lies here, who ultimately manages to take, you know, control of the situation. Tomorrow also we have a meeting of the Premier League clubs, but only 14 of them. The six Super League clubs have not been invited to those talks. So it'd be interesting to see actually what emerges from those talks as well.
Rob, a lot of emotion in it because it's a sport people love and they're invested in their teams. But from a business decision, this is surely just tapping into a global market instead of a domestic one.
Yeah, and it's sort of, you know, the interconnectivity of the world and the fact that, you know, is it hard to engage young fans these days to watch games, and do they actually tune in for the mega clashes as well? If you think, it's anecdotal, but how many people are sort of tuning into La Liga the whole time? How much often will they more like to tune in when it's a Clásico or Madrid derby rather than some sort of, you know, the lesser fixtures? And it's believing actually that the way to perhaps keep young viewers tuning in and keep them engaged is giving more glamorous pictures. The question is, do we enjoy them in Europe now because they're rarer? And if we do have Manchester United playing against Juventus far more regularly, actually it become pretty tedious. And also, the fans lose out so much as well. If the Super League is the only competition and they can't play in the Premier League, you know, those away days across England are completely gone. I mean, you're expecting fans to fly all across Europe, and you know, it is costly. I mean, obviously, currently now you can't really fly across as freely, but the hope is that it returns. But it's going to be really, you know, problematic, and it's the fans who haven't been considered, and the fans groups are really critical of all the Super League clubs in England.
And that's even if you can get tickets, Rob. That will be a massive issue as well. But just in terms of the consequences, so if we were to look down the line at what football will look like domestically in the UK, if these teams were to break away, and around Europe, if the big teams were to leave, what would it do to the game?
Well, it would be completely transformative. And I think that's why we find things hard to imagine. Like, we're not used to sort of seismic shots in our dives, where things, yes, in the last year, lockdown, things that we could never have imagined have existed. But, you know, you look at something like football and you sort of get used to the structures as they are and how things exist. It's not like a sport like cricket that's constantly changing. And, you know, we find it very hard, I think, to compute suddenly a completely different football ecosystem in a few months or so. And that's probably where it's so hard to envision at this point, and expect that they do come back from the brink.
Sorry, but can the likes of Liverpool, Manchester United, Man City survive solely on the Super League? Will they be able to financially survive without being in the Premier League?
Well, and where do players want to be? Do the players all sign up to it? Do they actually, you know, fear that for their own careers? They if they really are banned from the Euros, banned from the World Cup, how much does that actually mean for them? And that's why there's sort of big decisions for the players to make at this point as well. I mean, you know, does it null and void any of their contracts? Do they all flop to clubs that aren't in the Super League? Does suddenly new forces emerge? I mean, that's what is so much of the brinkmanship at the moment. And what we're seeing is the Super League clubs aren't really doing much to sell their case. They're not really they've no public voice. There is only opposition. Even their own fans, as the representative groups of the fan base of the clubs, aren't speaking up for it. So there is a void where they could be arguing the case, and they're just not doing it. And in it, you get suspicion, questions over the motivations, and you've got the UEFA leadership, who are sort of painting themselves as the moral guardians of football by attacking the sort of snakes, the liars and stuff, who are in control of the game. And it just sort of serves as a reminder about the way, you know, football, the game, you know, we love, can be sort of taken over, and how fans have lost control of it. And perhaps, you know, we look to clubs like Bayern that have actually sort of said they're not taking part in it. We look to sort of question, why is it due to the sort of fan ownership models there at all? And, you know, you look, Jimmy, there's now some pictures coming in from Elland Road tonight ahead of that Liverpool game, and fans are holding up a banner, love for the working class game, ruined by the greed and corruption, RIP, LSC, thanks for the memories.
Ken Early in the Times today asked a very pertinent question. He said, how can they get away with it? Or more like, who will stop them?
Well, the question is legally, do they succeed in it being stopped? Because that, where we're at is legal action has been threatened on all sides. You've got UEFA who are saying that they will pursue legal action to actually stop players and to stop this whole thing taking place, and they are considering their options. Then you've got the Super League clubs themselves who wrote to UEFA and FIFA overnight saying quite determinedly they've already started legal proceedings, and they are trying to sort of argue that they have the right to organise a competition. It shouldn't just be the preserve of UEFA to run things, to be the regulator of European football and the organiser of the competitions, also selling all the rights as well. So it's something that could be, you know, potentially argued in court significantly over just who has the right, and should a group of clubs, if they want to, have the validity to be able to just launch a competition if they can all agree it together.
Well, it sounds like it's a battle that's going to run for a while. Rob, thanks a million for taking our call. Enjoy the rest of your day. I'm sure you have more interviews to do yet.
Great to join you, and keep well.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks a million. Cheers. We have Stephen Kelly and Conan Byrne on the line as well. Stephen, I suppose from an ex-player's point of view, and also looking at it probably from a fan's point of view, what does this mean for the football that you know or that you see?
It just changes everything from what you grow up watching and wanting to play in. And I suppose as you're a kid, you have an aspiration. And for me, it was always an aspiration to play in the Premier League. I know we have the Irish League, but that was always where you want to get to. And there's a direct line of sight of how you get there. And even if you have to drop down the leagues, you can come up through it. Whereas this changes the model slightly, doesn't it? By having a fixed regime of players. And even for me, my progress getting to the Europa League with Fulham, I know it's a different competition, but we got there out of the blue. We got to a final. Like, stuff like that, those fairy tales can't happen in a situation like this. You can't have those teams that are both out of blue and they somehow rise to the top against all the odds. It changes it, the dynamic of football completely, and it just is. It's about greed and money, and that's not what football's been about. Football's been more than that. It's not always been a perfect business model. People have funded clubs and lost so much, but they've done it for the fan base and their love of their club. That's changed, and that it just seems to be going such a wrong direction for what everybody wants.
Conan, that's a really romantic way for Stephen to look at it, but sometimes I think if you take a bit of a step back, there's probably a different view as well. And I know that you're a teacher and I know that you have kids, and I said it to my kids today and they were like, oh yes, that sounds brilliant. We get to see the big teams play every single week. They want to watch stuff on YouTube. They don't have that kind of same love for the underdog, the beauty of it, the romanticism, because they weren't exposed to it. They just see Neymar, Mbappe, Salah, and they want to see them all the time.
Yeah, I was had a bit of a debate in the classroom today. All right, about it. All the children were coming in, asking questions and fantasising about what this super league is the possibility of it. Obviously, like Stephen, I'm completely against it. It's a league without competition. Imagine a team that can't be relegated and a super league that is meant to be like the best teams. Yes, Bayern Munich, PSG, obviously aren't going to be taking part in it. And there are two teams that competed in last year's Champions League final, the biggest competition in European football. I can't believe I'm defending the owners of PSG, by the way, but the French and German clubs are thinking about their number one concern, and that's the fans. And that's the kind of point that I was trying to put through to the children in my classroom today, is that like the people involved in these clubs, the owners of these clubs, the Abramovichs, the Levies, the Glazers, Henrys, Goenkas, they've never kicked a football in their lives. They've never supported a club from the terraces like we all have. And it's just very, very disappointing to listen to the news coming out last night. And it's not going to be the end of it. Like, even like the likes of AC Milan and Inter, owned by US hedge funds, Chinese owners, Inter are out of their depth completely in terms of financially incompetent. Like, how are these teams even getting involved in it? They're not even good enough for a Super League. And, it's very concerning.
Stephen, so you can make the point too that the questions could be asked about Arsenal and even Spurs. How are they getting into a Super League? They're super rich owners. But is it really wealthy business people just trying to make a business more profitable? Is it as simple as that?
Oh, that's exactly what it is. And, you know, from the business model or economically, that makes complete sense. It's something that you can't get in football, which is certainty. You're getting a guaranteed amount of money every season, and you're guaranteed to be in that league, which is music to the ears of any businessman or anybody that wants to have a successful company. And that makes sense. It does totally make sense. I can completely understand that. But it doesn't make sense from every other aspect of football that I've grown up to love and watch and be part of and play in. It just changes that. And I find it very hard to think that this would happen, because with all the stuff coming out about players being banned from major competitions and possibly these teams being kicked out of the league, like, I just can't see those teams not playing in the Premier League. I just don't think that will happen. They're not going to go from the Premier League and the Champions League to play in a single competition that consists of, 15 teams? That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
We've had a text in wondering, would we as football fans still support the teams that we do if they were to join a Super League? And I actually spoke about this at home today, and we were teasing it out. If Liverpool were to go and join this Super League, would we try and encourage our children and ourselves to go and support another team, one of the lower teams, and go to their matches and go over to England like we used to do before if this does happen, and just go back to I guess what's right and what's good about football. And as Conan pointed out, that is going to the terraces, or we'd probably go to a lot more League of Ireland matches as well. Conan, Ruby, what would you do?
I was going to ask you the same question, Marie. Do you even know where Burnley is?
No.
Where would you fly to go and watch Burnley play?
What about Leeds? Leeds all the way.
Leeds. I don't know, but look, would I still follow Manchester United? I probably would, but I'd still watch the Premier League for whoever was playing in it. Simple as that. But I don't know. Stephen, you put yourself in the position of one of the players in one of these clubs that could be in the Super League with the threat of losing the ability to play for your national team. How much sway will that have in what players do?
I think it'd be huge. I think it'd be absolutely huge. Especially World Cups and European competitions. Like, you look at England at the current moment, you think that this is an opportunity for them to possibly go and win a major tournament. And if you're a club like, say, Harry Kane at Spurs, who at the moment looks like he's probably not going to win anything at Tottenham, realistically, and his best chance of winning a major competition is probably going to be with his national team because of how good they are. If he takes that, you take that away from him. I said the possibility of him staying at Spurs could be increased because of the chance he could win the Euros in the summer. You know, that's gone. I know, obviously, now you're in a competition, an elite group, a team where it's a smaller number, so you have probably a better chance of actually winning something, but it's just taking away international football. It's crazy. That's the pinnacle of my career. That for me was, you bleed green, you want to play for Ireland. To not have that as an option when you're an elite football are playing at the best, getting picked for your country is the tick, the reward for being at that level. And to take that away from you, it would be catastrophic.
Now that you have brought up Spurs there, what do you think about Jose getting the sack, Stephen?
I know it's been a busy day for news coming out of Spurs, to say the least. It's crazy. I'm really shocked by it, I have to admit. Not that I thought that Jose, and we spoke on the show so often about how, I'm a fan of him, but I don't think a lot of people are, and I think it was only going to end one way. He was losing the fans, the way the team were playing. They were up in games and losing points from winning positions, and it just wasn't going well. But for the timing of it, that's what's so strange. For him to get sacked a few days away from a cup final, which we all know he's one of the best people in the world at getting trophies over the line, it just seems like a crazy decision, and something that is very unorthodox when it comes to Daniel Levy, because everything seems calculated and done with precisionness, and this just seems not the norm for Tottenham.
Conan, I'm looking forward to actually hearing from Jose now, to hear what he has to say, because the timing is very strange, all right. And that, as Stephen said, I think that's probably what shocked people the most, that it was just after the Super League announcement that Jose was gone.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, look, going back to what Stephen was saying there about Daniel Levy, I don't know if anybody watched the Amazon Prime documentary on Spurs. It's really outlined Levy's leading role in bringing Mourinho into the club. It's the man he wanted, and it's kind of backfired on him massively, considering that he hasn't lasted nearly a year. And the poor results, obviously, they've lost 7 of the previous 14 Premier League games, only winning 5 of them. The FA Cup defeat to Everton was a big, obviously, with Jose Mourinho, he loves cup competitions. And then just a collapse in the Europa League at the hands of Dynamo Zagreb, 2-0 up from the first leg and losing 3-2 to a team like that. No disrespect to them, it shouldn't have happened. Obviously, worries about their style of play. Under Poch, it was fantastic attacking football. But under Mourinho, it was like once they got a goal up, it was sit in, park the bus. Similar trait that has won him trophies over the years, and that's probably why Levy brought him in, to try and get a trophy over the line. But then you have to look at the other side of things as well. Potential new signings, possibly worried about the strained tensions within the squad. Mourinho obviously not getting on well with some of his players. If you're looking to attract top players into a team, into a squad, and you're seeing the manager not having good relationships with the players within that squad at the moment, it would put doubts into your head about whether or not you want to sign for the club. And Hugo Lloris admitted after the Zagreb game that the togetherness was gone within the team. And when that goes, it's very, very difficult to regain that.
Stephen, it just wasn't a great weekend for you, was it? Did Arsenal push Fulham over the edge?
I think that was it. Yeah, I've had some great weekends on the show, but this weekend has not been a very successful one, to be perfectly honest. Tottenham losing the manager, club being ruined by being taken to a Super League possibly, and then, you know, everything else that goes with it with Fulham. So no, not been a great weekend, but it was just one of those games where they pushed and pushed and pushed, and Fulham looked really good for it, but Arsenal somehow came back and got that equaliser, and it was just, I think that was the nail in the coffin for them.
It was a good weekend for Ruby, though, at Manchester United, getting the job done against Burnley. Conan?
Yeah, absolutely. Great win. Poor first half display, playing that fake nine again. But obviously, when you bring on a player like Cavani, he just changes games. He's done that really, really well over the last couple of weeks. Mason Greenwood shows the kind of type of player he's going to be. Absolutely clinical in front of goal, two goals. And then the icing on the cake for Cavani. So, great win for Manchester United. See you at second spot, really. And, yeah. Fair play. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hasn't got the credit he's deserved, I think. I think it's gone under the radar a little bit. Obviously, he's still a little bit to learn. He's still young as a manager within the Premier League, but he's grown into that role really, really well. And he's fantastic to finish in second place.
Yeah, I agree with you, Conan. He's starting to win me around anyway, so he is. But did Newcastle, getting the goal against West Ham, Stephen, do Liverpool a favour if they can beat Leeds tonight? Can't believe they might have.
Top four.
I think they did. And we spoke about so often about how I felt Liverpool would creep back in there, and West Ham, for all their endeavour, and I think they've been excellent. They've played some really great football, and they've you know, very good for where they are. You know, to lose to a team like Newcastle, they're on the up, they're improving and getting those players back.
Ah, Stephen, come on, it was awesome, a horror show. The keeper and the defenders and everything. I mean, they beat themselves.
I know they did. But that when you think of where they are now, to throw it away like that, that's the issue with West Ham. And to give Liverpool an opportunity to climb themselves back out of it where it looked like it was dead and buried, I always felt that West Ham wouldn't be in a position at the end of the season where they'd stay there, just because I just felt that they wouldn't have the consistency. But, you know, Newcastle, I think, have gone from strength to strength. They don't look great on the eye, but they're just able to get wins. And at the moment now, they look like they're just going to take that away from Fulham.
We're getting so many texts in about this European Super League. So many football fans out there. But Daniel in Cork has said that he's a Liverpool fan for 33 years. He's also a Dundalk fan and he lives in Cork. But he's going to be dragging his kids to Turner's Cross every week if this league was to go ahead. He said he would never support Liverpool again. A lot of people seem to have that thought, Conan. But they will have to tune in tonight to see if Liverpool do beat Leeds and get into that top four and almost nearly justify their position in the European Super League.
Absolutely. But the other thing is, though, if they go into the Super League, can you imagine, like, I remember as a kid, the first fixtures I'd look at obviously would be Manchester United and then Everton. Imagine the fact of having a no Merseyside derby in the future if Liverpool get into the Super League and the Premier League refuse Liverpool into the Premier League. So, and the irony, I suppose, of Premier League clubs going mad is, like, a lot of people criticise English clubs and Sky Sports for the formation of the Premier League in the historic context of the early 90s, like post-Taylor Report, post-Hillsborough, post-stadium disasters of Bradford and Heysel, as well as Hillsborough itself, post the Euro Club ban. It was a very easy sell at the time. And, like, promotion and relegation remained. We all have enjoyed and revelled in a success over the last 30 years. So the point that, like, it could possibly work and do really, really well. But I think back then in the early 90s, the Premier League was needed. This Super League, it's just going to ruin the game.
Okay, well, last word on the Super League to you, Stephen. Do you think it's going to go through?
No,
you're back.
No, I can't see it. I just can't, especially if FIFA and UEFA and the Premier League are going to be as stern as they're saying that these teams will be banned from those competitions. For the life of me, I know the owners probably don't care about English football. They can go up watching it. Don't, you know, that's different. It's a business for them. But there's no way those teams could possibly leave the English Premier League. So if that's if the FA is sticking to their guns and like you're out of Premier League if you're going to play in this league, then it can't happen.
Okay, well, as Ruby said earlier, this is going to run and run and we'll probably be chatting about it for quite a lot. Stephen Kelly, thanks so much for joining us. Conan, stay with us because amidst all of the chaos today, Dundalk confirmed that their coach, Filippo Givagnoli, had departed the club. This was after the draw against St. Pat's over the weekend, and it comes after Shane Keegan had departed as team manager, and it seems that Giuseppe Rossi is going to remain part of the coaching team. So there's a lot going on here as well that probably has gone under the radar a little bit with all of the huge football news, but still it's a real mess for Dundalk.
It is, and obviously Shane Keegan left his role on Friday, and I think he had to leave his role to keep some sort of credibility for himself. Like, it's just been an absolute mess. Filippo Giovagnoli has obviously told his players that the game against St. Patrick's Athletic on Saturday would be his last game. And then I think we have to look back on Filippo's reign as a really, really positive one, Marie, because he came in at a time where Dundalk were really, really struggling. They were knocked out of the Champions League qualifying round by Celje. They were really struggling domestically as well in terms of form. And he managed to turn it around. He won three straight games in a row, to put them into the group stages of the Europa League. And then he went on to Shamrock Rovers, who were unbeaten in all of 2020 in the cup final in the Aviva in December. So I think we have to remember Filippo as a really positive influence in the Dundalk dressing room. However, he only had his A licence, and you can't bring him in managers into any sort of level of football, at the like elite level, without having a pro licence. And I think that was the writing on the wall. It was always going to happen that was the case. And once that happens, you obviously have to bring in somebody that has a pro licence. And then you have the media, you have people talking, even the players within the dressing room might be asking, like, who do I listen to? Do I listen to Shane? Do I listen to Filippo? It's just a mess.
From even Conan, the management situation, which I think everyone will agree has been a mess since this season started. But behind the scenes as well, there seems to be an awful lot of chaos. And Alan Cawley was actually quite strong at the weekend on the radio about it. And he said that Dundalk could be left with no legacy from their long period of success because of everything that is going on.
I might disagree with that slightly, because obviously Dundalk have done really, really well over the last number of years getting to the group stages of the Europa League. I can understand Alan's concerns in terms of the ground that they are in. It's really, really poor. It needs huge investment. But I don't think anybody will forget their period of dominance over the last number of years. I just think that people within the club, they just need to have a stable footing and get that stable footing very, very, very quickly. I think the next appointment will be key to the future of Dundalk in terms of success on the pitch. And Jim McGilton now is going to obviously have to bring in somebody that he can trust, that he can rely on, that is going to bring the football club back to where it belongs. They've had a terrible start to the season, as we all know, but it's still very, very early days yet. And they still have a European campaign to get underway in the summer as well. So it's not all doom and gloom. It just hasn't started well this season. But the next appointment at Dundalk is going to be crucial.
So right now, associated with the job, Gerard Little, former Sligo Rovers boss, Linfield manager David Healy, and also Vinnie Perth, has said that he wouldn't rule out going back. Who do you think should go into the role?
Well, I think Vinnie Perth should run an absolute mile from the job, considering how they treated him the last time. Even just in terms of self-respect, I think Vinnie Perth should stay away from the role after the way they treated him. In terms of... I can see the reasons behind Gerard Little, because Jim McGilton and him are very, very good friends. Gerard Little was Jim McGilton's number two when he worked as head of development at the IFA. And they're very, as I said, they're good friends outside of football. They share the same agent. And as I said earlier, Jim is going to want to get somebody in that he trusts and has around it and knows really, really well around the club. And that's what Jim needs. He needs somebody there that can bring the club forward. The only problem with Gerard is that he's been appointed as the under-17 and under-19 Northern Ireland international manager, and that's a full-time role. So if he was to take the Dundalk job, he'd have to be relieved of his duties by the IFA, which will leave a sour taste in their mouths as well.
Yeah, and it is a big risk just given everything that has happened. There is a full round of fixtures tomorrow in the League of Ireland and they will all be on Watch LOI. Conan, thanks so much for joining us, Ruby. We've got a very kind tweeter telling me to tell you that Burnley is 40 miles northeast of Haydock Park.
I know where it is. I was testing.
Game on 2FM.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Welcome back. Now, we can get angry and upset and outraged about the European Super League and football, but it is only sport. There is a lot more important things than that. And I think a lot of people realise that when it was confirmed that amateur rider Lorna Brooke had died in hospital on Sunday following a fall earlier this month. Devastating news, Ruby, and definitely, I think, a reality check for people when we're given out about the smallest things.
Yeah, it is, Marie. And I think it shouldn't really take such sad things to remind us of what's the difference between what is reality. And this is very, very sad. Lauren obviously had a very bad fall on the 8th of April at Taunton Racecourses when she got a fall from a horse trained by her mum, Lady Susan Brooke, called Orchestrated. You know, a seasoned handicap chaser. He'd run 18 times over fences but took a really heavy fall. And unfortunately, Lorna didn't recover from her injuries. And I guess on Friday, when you read the latest report, you could guess that things were going downhill in the wrong direction. And it's very, very sad for Lorna. Our thoughts are with her family, who are and she was steeped in racing. She was 37 years of age, but she had ridden as an amateur all her life and did it for fun. And sadly, Lorna joins the list that no jockey wants to be on. And may she rest in peace with all the other riders that have lost their lives down the years.
And maybe we've seen some reaction from the racing community, and I think the jockeys in particular, like it, I think it really hits hard because it is such a small community and everybody knows each other.
I think it's that untalked about reality, Marie, that is always there for every jockey. You never talk about it, you never think it's going to be you. But when you think about Darry Cullen, Jack Tyner, Kieran Kelly, Sean Cleary, John Thomas McNamara, Tom Halliday, Richard Davis, it's there, but you just don't ever really want to admit it.
And then when it happens, you just have to deal with it and think about it, I'd imagine, and just realise that you were one of the lucky ones.
Exactly, that's it, that you were the lucky one. So, look, or as I said already, our thoughts are with our family, and very sad time for them all.
Yeah, very much so. And it's actually a really difficult thing to move on from, but we are going to do that. And Dunica, we're going to move on to rugby now because there was a big game for Ireland at the weekend, a Six Nations game. We talked about it all week. We got our hopes up. We were excited. We were given out about Emily Scarrett. But unfortunately, Ireland came up short against France. And it is France and England now that will contest that finals. And France or Ireland have to go on and play Italy in the third, fourth place game.
Absolutely, Marie. And to be honest, it was a difference in class. And look, the biggest thing you can say is it's semi-professionals versus professionals. And it was very clear. And I think Niamh Briggs made a good point afterwards about when she was speaking about, you know, just the engagement of young girls playing and just the importance of getting girls playing rugby at a young age. An awful lot of our girls that are playing at the moment are transitioning over from other sports, which is great, and it's really important. But what we probably don't have at the moment is people playing it from a young age and just having the behaviours and the small things that come from playing it at a very young age. So it was disappointing. We didn't get too high after we beat Wales by 45 points, so we shouldn't get as low when we lost to France.
For yourself, I was delighted.
But I don't think our performances were, you know, in between that.
Yeah, I think Ciara Griffin said that afterwards in her interview as well. She just said, look, it looks bad on the scoreline. Yeah. That she agreed the performance wasn't as bad as was being reflected by the numbers. But I think you probably nailed it there. There's a reality there and it needs to be addressed. And it's going to be impossible nearly to close that gap until we have the proper systems and structures in place. We heard Fiona Coughlin on the commentary talking about how many England under 21s were going into training camp and then stating the fact that we don't even have an under 20 structure.
And as well, Marie, you don't want to deflect as well from the girls' performance. It was parts of the game that need to improve. 20 penalties in total, kind of 18 with 15 minutes to go. You just can't give yourself a foothold in the game if you're going to do that. You know, at international level, you need to be in around 6 penalties, max 8. You know, we're giving away 20 of them, a lot of unforced errors. So you don't want to, blame it all on the structures. The structures need to change, and we do need to fix that and get it right. But the performances need to be better as well. And I think they will be. It's a really big game now against Italy at the weekend. If we could finish third, and not only that, set ourselves up in nicely coming into World Cup qualification. So it was, you know, there was still good things. Stacey Flood, I hadn't seen a whole lot of her, but she came on and made a massive impact. We didn't probably see Beveen or Doherty as much as that we would have liked, but they were the heads on stakes. Any time they came near the ball, they just got wiped out. You could see France basically address them early in the week and identify them as key players to go after. So, look, it was disappointing, but like we said, hopefully we can bounce back this weekend against Italy.
That's for sure. And what about the scrum, Donoghue? Because I know you were getting so excited about it beforehand.
Yeah, and look, I think what we probably identified it like that, you know, when France were able to bring on more quality, and there's a worrying thing that's happening, and I think Italy have started it, where you put probably your best scrummaging forwards on the bench. So that in the last 20 minutes, and you know, for all you look at that French front five that came on near the end, you know, they were colossal and were able to probably take advantage of inexperience. But I still think we'll be so disappointed with one, individual errors, and two, really bad reads, just setups in defence. You might get away with it at other level, but you can't set up at international level with people in wrong positions. The class is just too good, and they just score from just simple little things that you'll get away with at provincial level and at club level. And look, that's a worry as well at the moment. Our girls have had two games in 13 months. We need our AAL back up and firing. But look, there's greater issues that you don't want to take away from the performance. Hopefully we'll go better against Italy, but it needs support, it needs help.
Yeah, and there are things as well that they can work on, and we will be previewing that Italy game a little bit later on the week. We're also going to be returning to the Super League later on in the show, but we're going to take a very quick break and return with hurling.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, the All-Ireland Hurling Champions Limerick will begin their title defence against Cork in a Munster Senior Hurling Championship semi-final. The quarter-final will be contested by Clare and Waterford, and the winner of that plays Tipperary in the second semi-final. And now I'm delighted to say that Shane McGrath joins us. And Shane, I have to say, we've missed you.
So happy.
Nice. Missed you too. Look, see, the first days I'm back, loads of sport. See,
that's
there you
it.
Go.
Yeah,
there you go.
Just the common denominator. Well, I've actually missed you more because you're usually slagging Ruby, and very few of us get away with that.
Yeah, I know. Slagging about Limerick again this year, yeah?
I know, Limerick are sound. Not against Limerick. Sure, look, the best jockey in the world is from Tip at the moment. So, look, it's all good, isn't it, Ruby?
Dead right, Shane, you're dead right, boy.
Didn't take you long. So, Shane, look, we do have the Munster hurling draw, and it's actually going to come around really quickly. Usually we get these draws months out in advance, but this one actually isn't too bad. But we do have a league first, which will probably tell a lot. But you have to wonder, with the league and the championship coming so close, are people really going to bother and show much of a hand in the league, do you think?
Yeah, it's hard to know, Marie, like, because I suppose if your team's going back training there tonight, like, say, and they'll probably have a 3-4 week run into the league. So, and I suppose managers are going to look at it in one of two ways, that, okay, they want to use the league to try out some tactical things, try out guys in different positions or things like that. Or do they want to say, look, this is the only prep we'll have, like, you know, because I'm sure the lads Dunnick would agree there, like, internal games. You'll get so much out of internal games, but it's just not the same as kind of competitive environment that you get in the league. So it's hard to know what way managers are going to approach the league. You also have to take into account that it's a lot of games in a short space of time. So you have 4 games in the league, maybe 5 games for teams, a week or two off max, and then you're into the championship. And, like, you know, even if you look at the draws for the Munster Championship, I mean, if you take Cork, for example, like, who've drawn against Limerick, I mean, do they want to, you know, give everything for those 4 or 5 weeks in the league and maybe be a little bit flat for the Limerick game? Or, you know, it's really, really hard one to call, Marie, how teams will approach it. I think it is a matter of whoever has the best panel once again will come out on top. And I think I do honestly think Limerick have the best panel that they could use between 20 to 25 guys in the league, still be very competitive, maybe win it. And, you know, still John Kiley still have a headache then to pick for the championship. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see. But I feel a lot of managers will go hard at the league, because you know, it's the only bit of competitiveness they're going to get, like.
And nobody will probably want to go out in the first game either and be all guns blazing, or people will think they've been training for months, Shane.
Yeah, sure. Look, the main thing of this here, Marie, is that the footballers are all very bold and that the hurlers are all very good. And that's it in a nutshell. Or else ignorance is bliss and all that, they say. So, look, it's great to see them all officially back tonight anyway. You know, it's great to see the draw this morning there. It even is a little bit of a buzz, you know, just seeing the draw. And, you know, I'm sure all the lads are going training tonight, you know, with that extra bit of a buzz, going back training and then knowing who you're preparing for in championship. And, you know, you'll get your chance in the Munster Championship and the Leinster Championship, and you'll get one more go at it then, which, you know, which is very lucky for the hurlers, because the footballers don't have that. So, look, it'll be a very interesting few weeks ahead. And I'm sure no one is allowed in watching training, but I'm sure there'll be not much given away in the next few weeks as to how teams are going to set up. But that's great. It's great to have it back. Anyway, great to have the draws done, and everyone really looking forward to the year ahead. Like,
Shane, would you think Tip came out the worst side of that draw? It's seen as Clare and Waterford will have a quarter final before they meet Tip. Limerick and Cork will take each other on first of all. Is that draw and Tip in Munster, that one team in a semi final, is that a disadvantage or an advantage?
I think any draw that you can avoid Limerick in your first game, Ruby, is a good draw, in my opinion. Because, you know, I just think they're at the top and the rest of us are trying to play catch up at the moment. So if you can avoid Limerick for as long as you can, I think you've a great chance of going well in Munster. You know, I'd say the Tip boys now, you know, they'll know they'll have the extra week because they're in straight into semi final. So they might go a bit harder at the league games, or, you know, really, really want to push on in the league and try and get as much as they can out of that. The Waterford and Clare one is going to be a very interesting game. I suppose Waterford gave them a bit of a trimming last year down at Cork, beating them by 9 points. And, you know, like, what will Clare do maybe if Tony Kelly doesn't have a good year? Like, so it's, you know, there's a lot of questions there. I know, Marie, you're not too happy when I be talking about the Clare boys like that, but...
To be honest, Shane, I'm just really happy that we're actually talking about them, about hurling, because it's been all about what's been going on behind the scenes and at county board level, that it's nice to actually start focusing on matches and how Tony Kelly's going to play. So just far
it is
away.
Absolutely. And you know what, Marie, it's actually great to see your club, that Club Clare thing going. I suppose you're even reading Anthony Daly's article recently, like, Clare are probably a good few years behind the rest of the counties in regards to getting associations like that up and running. But look, I mean, I think the players will have to do their talking on the pitch this year. So the Waterford-Clare game will be very interesting. I think Waterford coming into it in a great place. Second year now for Liam Cahill, he'll know what he has, you know, and they'll have great confidence going into it. So that'll be a great game. And then, you know, all neutral venues as well, Ruby, will be great. Like, so I just, you know, I was even just talking about it on Twitter today. I'd love to see some people going to the matches, Ruby. I don't know what your opinions on it, lads. You know, my opinions are, if anyone that can go should go, and we don't want to discriminate against people, but I mean, there's a good chance I won't. Yeah, what I'm saying, Marie, is, like, it's a good chance I won't be vaccinated, you know, or the likes of my friends or our age group won't be vaccinated. But I'd have no bother with people who are vaccinated, younger than me or older than me, because they're frontline workers or whatever, being allowed to go to the matches. So I'd love to see some crowds there. Like, so my thing would be, if it's safe for people who are vaccinated to go to the matches, let them go to the matches and let the rest of us go whenever our time will be. This isn't forever, like, you know, eventually we will get to all go to the matches again. And, you know, we are getting towards the light at the end of the tunnel, closer and closer each day passes. So
it's
great to have the Munster Championship.
But I thought Eamon Sweeney wrote a very good article in the back of last Sunday's Independent about how important is sport, and it kind of made me realise how lucky we were in sport to have been able to do what we have done through the pandemic. And I don't know exactly where I stand. Should sport be pushing the boundaries, looking for spectators, or should we just be delighted that we were actually able to continue? And I probably don't know where I stand on that, really, to be honest with you.
I would stand on the side, Ruby, get people to the matches if it's safe to do them. I throw out this thing of a vaccine passport. I don't know, is it actually even been thought about or spoke about, but with anybody with the hierarchy yet? But
and even the antigen testing they're doing in the UK is incredible, and that's what they're going to use to get people back into sporting venues is going with antigen testing on top of people who are already vaccinated. But they've started to accept antigen testing in the UK, whereas we're still as we are far behind them in the vaccine rollout, we're as far behind them in our acceptance of antigen testing as well.
Well, I have to say, Shane McGrath, you're right. It won't be forever. So we will see how it progresses over the next few weeks. Thanks so much for joining us. And in case anybody missed it, the Munster football final also happened today. The Connacht Senior Football Championship draw was taking place right now on the 6-1 News. And then tomorrow, the Ulster Senior Football Championship draw and the Leinster Senior Hurling Championship, hurling and football championships will also be going on tomorrow. And all of them will be up on RTÉ.
Game on. Josh, on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. As we said, we will return to the Super League news at the top of the, we had at the top of the show, and Fergal Brennan has joined us on the line. Fergal, is there any truth in the rumour that UEFA will have a meeting in the next 24 hours where there will be a motion formally put forward to expel Manchester United and Arsenal from the Europa League, Man City, Chelsea and Real Madrid from the Champions League?
Yeah, that is the case. As it stands, there'll be another meeting again tomorrow. There's been a number of meetings today with UEFA and their executive committee, and that'll be a case again tomorrow. And you're right in saying that's item one on the agenda, the possible expulsion of any teams that have agreed to join the breakaway European Super League, being kicked out of Europe this season. And obviously that would have a huge impact on the Europa League and the Champions League. As it stands, UEFA are serious about this. The statements from Alexander Seferin, the UEFA president, earlier today are pretty clear. He's personally very angry. UEFA as an organisation are very angry about the situation, and they will push for this. The last 24, 48 hours have been absolutely mental, so I wouldn't really rule anything out at this stage, but they will push for this. They are serious about essentially ending the Europa League and the Champions League this season, based on what they're framing as a betrayal by certain clubs. Whether it'll go through or not, the sensation, kind of as things have died down in the last hour or two, is that it probably won't kick in for this season, just due to the fact that if it does happen in the next 24 or 48 hours, each of those clubs will then launch a legal challenge, which will then kind of go backward and forward for a week or so, which by which time would then be at the Champions League semi-finals. So they will probably be allowed to play. The gut instinct is that this season's competition will finish, but then we're in for a very, very rocky summer.
And it looks like Bruno Fernandes is one of the first players to have rode in behind the support against the Super League. He liked a tweet by Wolves winger Daniel Podence, which was given out about it.
Yeah, and it kind of echoes Ander Herrera's statement earlier on today, which has really come down hard on the move of these clubs to move away from the current system and the current structures of leagues and European competitions. And I think it's a very difficult situation for a lot of players because they are contracted to clubs. And I will imagine in the last, again, 24 to 48 hours, club press officers, media departments will have spoken to players to say, please do not comment on this if you're asked. Wait until there's an official line from the club on how we'll respond. In saying that, players will be angry, and you know, the odd one will slip through the cracks, like Fernandes or Podence or Herrera. But I think for the moment, because clubs tend to be very tight organisations when it comes to media access and also players being able to speak publicly, even if that is through private social media accounts, I'm not anticipating a flood of players coming out and criticising this, even if the sensation is that the bulk of them do seem to be against it. I think it will be a drip effect in the next week or so, but players will be annoyed about this because an enormous amount of control over their own careers is being taken away from them.
Fergal Brennan, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be keeping an eye on that over the next few days. That's it, lads. I'm home to watch Leeds and Liverpool on Sky. The irony of it.
What's the protest outside, Marie? Apparently that's a bigger crowd outside the ground than there is even in there. Well, there's no one in there, is there?
All right, lads. See you tomorrow.